stories told on a pure and blessed morn. A tiny boy bringing love and joy, the Prince of Peace.
Thank you, Alvin. Good morning. As I travel around the country, one of the things that's always with me, no matter where I go, is the weather. And I can go down into Florida like we did last April. In the first part of April last year, we were in a campground down in the Ocala National Forest, down by Orlando. And in April, it was 102 degrees, and I think the humidity was 150. And there was jungle and palmettos and things that bit and scratched everywhere. And in this campground with us was a group of people that was having a four-wheeler meet. These little four-wheelers you run around on with the big tires, you know, you get a straddle like a motorcycle. And when these people would get dressed up in the day to go out into the jungle, they'd get dressed up in their leather jackets, their leather pants, their helmet, their leather gloves, and their rubber boots. And they'd spend all morning out there in that jungle running around with this stuff. I broke into a sweat in my air-conditioned trailer watching them do this. And when I'd make the comment about, boy, that's hot. That's not hot. Well, you know, compared to what I think's hot, that's hot. Well, when I realized that to them, they wear their winter coats when it's 75 degrees, they don't know what hot is. Last February, I was up in Idaho with Joel Yates, and it was 20 below. That's cold. And the snow was so high in places that it was about as high as the peak in this room here, this ceiling, and it was going over the houses, the snowdrifts were. And they didn't understand why we were all bundled up, because it ain't cold out here. And they couldn't imagine 102 degrees. They don't know what hot is. Because when it gets to 60, they're in a heat wave. Well, the reason I'm telling you this, we are a product of our own element, our own world, our own neighborhood, and we get set in the ways that we see things, and we start developing our lives along those lines. And one of the big dangers of that is sometimes we never bother to look over the fence to see what it's really like somewhere else or with something else. There's a passage on page 628 in the Book of Mormon that I want to talk about. This is when Christ came to this continent. I'm going to read part of what I call his orientation speech. In other words, this is who I am, this is what I'm about, and this is why I'm here. And this is what you can expect of me, and this is what I expect of you. That's an orientation speech. I'm going to start with verse 44. Behold, I am Jesus Christ, the Son of God. I created the heavens and the earth and all things that in them are. And I was with the Father from the beginning. I am in the Father, and the Father in me. And in me hath the Father glorified his name. We all know this. Some of us could probably go right along with me and never look at it. I came into my own, and my own received me not, and the scriptures concerning my coming are fulfilled. And as many as have received me, to them have I given to become the sons of God. Even so will I, as to as many as shall believe on my name. For behold, by me redemption cometh, and in me is the law of Moses fulfilled. I am the light and the life of the world. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. And ye shall offer up unto me no more shedding of blood, no more the shedding of blood. Yea, your sacrifices and your burnt offerings shall be done away, for I will accept none of your sacrifices and your burnt offerings, and ye shall offer for a sacrifice unto me a broken heart and a contrite spirit. And whoso cometh unto me with a broken heart and a contrite spirit, him will I baptize with fire and the Holy Ghost, even as the Lamanites, because of their faith in me, at the time of their conversion, were baptized with fire and with the Holy Ghost, and they knew it not. And behold, I have come into the world to bring redemption into the world and save the world from sin. Therefore, whoso repenteth and cometh to me as a little child, him will I receive, for of such is the kingdom of heaven. Can you tell me why Jesus Christ came to this earth? It's right in there. I read it in the next to the last verse. Is to save you and me from sin. Y'all know what sin is? You've been reading about it all your Christian lives. Do you really know what sin is? You can read it in Galatians. Where did it come from? Why do they call it sin? You know, when it started off, as far as the verbiage of it goes, when Adam and Eve committed the first sin, they didn't call it that. Said it was wrong. And they knew it was wrong. And we know why they knew it was wrong, because they had their eyes open and they were given to know the difference between two things, good and evil. So we can assume by that evil is sin, right? Okay, so what's evil? What's good? You want to get out into the world today and go through the political awareness and all of the things that go on today, and you want to accept their definition of what's evil and what's good? I don't think I want to. There's a man in the Bible that there are three completely different religions. Well, yeah, there are three religions that all trace their heritage, I guess you'd say, back to him. And the man's name is Abraham. And if there was any one mortal, and I'm discounting Jesus Christ here on this earth, that had an effect on you, it was Abraham. Abraham is why you're sitting here today, temporarily. You remember that he was the father of our faith. I guess that's a good way to say it. But when God told him about sin and to stay away from it, how did he know what he was talking about? And what was it that he had to do differently in his world, in his civilization, and in his society that set him apart and made him a peculiar person from his neighbors? In the world of Abraham, as he was growing up, and up to the time that he was about 100 years old, his name is Abram, and they had a very religious world. They're in Mesopotamia, Samaria, the city of Ur, and it was one of pagan myths and of pagan gods. And there's all kinds of sources out here in archaeology and history that'll tell you all about that religious world that those people lived in. First off, if you look at anything that has to do with a pagan god, you'll never see a group that has a pagan god. They always have pagan gods, plural. There's always more than one. That's a common thread amongst every myth, every pagan religion, every heathen, whatever you want to call it, that there is. There's another common thread that goes through all of these civilizations and their, quote, religions. All of these gods have emotions. They hate. They conspire. They do bad things. They're spitefully, maliciously jealous. That's one of the ways when you're reading something, if you take a look at those two things, it doesn't take you too long to realize what you're reading. The religion that the country of Abraham, that Abram lived in then, came to light in 600 BC. And there are seven tablets that they discovered that were written in the language of cuneiform. I guess I'm saying that right. And it had to do with 50 pagan gods in the myth. They grew up around these 50 pagan gods. They mentioned the Tower of Babel. Or Babel. They mention the Sphinx in it. And they mention the Zodiac in it. And they had a different god name for every one of our planets, including the sun. And they had all of these, the god of the sun, the god of the moon, the god of this, the god of that, like they all do, all these pagan gods. And the god of the moon was named Sin. And when you read these tablets, there's at least three different places on the internet where you can go and read these tablets. They've been translated, of course, from cuneiform into English. They all say basically the same thing. And you to read the history of these pagan gods back then, and if you would mix the movie Conan the Barbarian, which I've never seen, but I've seen plenty of ads on it, and a soap opera, you would have this myth. This myth that this guy was one of the main figures in is so full of spite and malice and gossip and backstabbing and suspicion and deceit and adultery and murder and cheating and lying. It goes on and on and on. That was their religion. Those people worshipped those ideals. That's the world Abram grew up in. It was okay to do that. There's seven tablets. They're full of it. They're just full of that kind of stuff. Kind of like operas. Here, a couple of years ago, PBS, when they had something to fill in between programs, if they had like a 40-minute program and they had needed 10 minutes or something, they had a filler, and it was about operas. What are operas about? And it was real neat, and it was put together real nice, and they'd run through about six or seven of the main operas, and what was the theme of the opera? And, of course, it had all the visual aids to go with it. And they talk about how this guy slept with his sister, who shot this guy, who stole there, who lied about this, and they're just on and on and on. And then when it got done with that opera, it said, now, these are the things in this opera, and it tell you all the sins that were in that opera. And it was 10-15 minutes of this, and it was fascinating to me. I saw it probably four or five times. I wish I had a film of it, because boy, was it ever informational. Didn't have anything to do with nice music, didn't have anything to do with all the beautiful sets or the beautiful voices. It had to do with what they were singing about. And they were singing about the same thing that's on these seven tablets, where one of the main gods was Sin. So let's go back to Abraham. He was the first one that came to believe in one God. Boy, that was a earthshaker. Monotheism was totally unheard of. You had to have all these gods that for all of these things that you had to worship, and that controlled your life about all of this and that and the other. And here's this guy over here in this tabernacle or tents, what they called it. They called tents tabernacles then. And he believed in one God. And he used to stay away from sin. That's one of our main gods. You can look this up. I'm not making this up. You can look this up, and there's sources and sources about this. So then he goes along, and we know the story. He became Abraham. Sarah was his wife. They didn't have any kids. And Abraham is struggling mighty to get away from all of this sin that this society had grown up worshiping. And this society was advanced enough. They had all these customs and laws and practices and mores and all of these things that society does. One of the pits that they fell into was when Sarah didn't have a baby. What'd they do? She gave him Hagar, the maid. To have a baby with him, that was a custom of the day. That was part of that society. Wasn't part of God's law. Kind of like today. When we're going to do something that society dictates instead of what God's law says. And they had the consequences of it. So now you have Ishmael to deal with. And Ishmael was the son of Hagar, and Sarah didn't like it, even though it was her idea in the first place, because she was jealous. That's a facet of sin. But God protected him. God sent Hagar back. Ishmael was born. You look in the scriptures, it says, and he was a wild man, and his hand was against every man, and every man's hand was against him. And I can show you at least three places where God said that he would be with Ishmael, and he would make him a great nation. And he did. Because if you want to look at Ishmael today, go look at an Arab. They're all from Ishmael. So along comes Isaac. Which means laughter. Because Sarah was so happy at having a son. Isaac followed his father. You all know the story of when God required a sacrifice from Abraham. And he built an altar and he prepared to sacrifice Abraham. Abraham was prepared to sacrifice his son like God sacrificed his son. There's a parallel. There's a little sign, see. He was spared, of course. And when you look at Isaac today, you are looking at two groups of people. You are looking at the Jews and you are looking at the Christians. And that's how God fulfilled his promise to Abraham that he would be the seed of nations. And get them away from sin. In Galatians, I'm going to read you all about sin, just so you understand what I'm talking about. Chapter 5 of Galatians. These are the things that can tell you if you're looking at something that represents sin. And I'm going to start with, I'm going to start with a preface to this, which is verse 16. This I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. Two different things. What's God's law and what your emotions tell you to do. What God has preserved for the welfare of your soul down through the ages, or what your emotions drive you to do, and you decide to do that instead of do what the scriptures tell you. Two human things right there. For the flesh lusts against the spirit. You don't have to do a lot of talking to explain that. It's pretty straightforward. You lust against the spirit of the Lord. And I do too. Because we have emotions. For the flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary one to the other, so that ye cannot do the things that ye would. But if you be led of the Spirit, you're not under the law. If you be led of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, as it's taught in His gospel, you're not under the Mosaic law. You remember any passage in the New Testament? Who's talking? Who are they talking to? What are they talking about? And why are they talking about it? They're talking to the Jews here that didn't understand the gospel of Jesus Christ. And all they had to say was the law, and it just filled in that void. They all knew what that meant. Now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these. Adultery. I want you to look at the pecking order of these things. You tell me which is the worst sin, okay? And which is the least sin. Adultery. Fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness. Idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, that's arguing, emulation, that's envy, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envyings, murders, drunkenness, revelings. See where revelings is? See where envying is, right next to murder? There's no little sin. And there's no big high-profile sin that you got to pay attention to while you minimize the importance of the others that you can commit. All of these are sin. And I can show you probably a gazillion movies that are made and 100 gazillion soap operas or some of these sitcoms on weekend or on weeknights that are full of sin. And this country today is wrapped up so much in that you imitate it. If you watch it regularly, you imitate it, whether you know it or not. Because you don't know that 20 degrees below zero is cold, you think 70 below is cold. Or you think 67 degrees is hot, and 20 below is not cold. You haven't looked over the fence lately into your scriptures and read them for what they are. Which brings another passage to mind, a broken heart and a contrite spirit, meek and lowly, as a little child. How do you fit that into your spiritual makeup? How does that apply to your soul? When I say yours, I'm talking about mine too. I'm not leaving me out of this. When I see something that's a sin, how do I react to it? You can commit a sin by reacting against sin. You remember what I said was the descendants of Ishmael? The Arabs. It's a Muslim world. Muhammad, and all of the things that started back when Muhammad first supposedly had his experience and caused the creation of the Quran. And Isaac, and the Jews, and all of the things that they went through, taking the Torah, or Torah, or however I've heard it pronounced a half a dozen different ways, and what they did with it, like the Muslims did with the Quran, until Jesus Christ comes along and does what He does to save us from sin, and then how we Christians have taken those scriptures and you can bring them down to today, and what you see is the same thing. Some get it, some don't. Do you think that God removed the statement from Ishmael that he would be with him and his nation, or that he did the same thing with Isaac? Does God change? No, we do. Because in our daily lives and in our emotions and in the way we do things, we tend to put our own definitions on these labels for all kinds of reasons. I'm going to stay with this Isaac and Ishmael thing for a second. Let's go from that point on. Let's go out into the future. You've got the Jews. You've got the first five books of the Old Testament. Made it their Bible, their sacred text. And the first thing they did to start deviating from it by having an oral law. And when they changed the oral law, every generation, and they're still doing it, and they did it from the beginning, that's what the rabbi's job is. When they got to the point that they could no longer reconcile the two, because they'd worked on this one harder, the Mishnah, that took precedence. And if these two contradict the Bible and the Mishnah takes precedence. They don't care what their Torah says. I can say exactly the same thing about our Bible. From the time that it was compiled and put together, people have been tearing it up, tearing it down, taking it apart, rethinking it, looking at it differently. And they don't, and now today some people don't care what it says, they know what it means. Because they have their own oral law too. So do the Muslims. Right after the advent of the Muslim religion, the Muslims and the Jews and the Christians all lived in Baghdad. They lived in peace. They lived in harmony. It was the greatest cultural and educational and financial city of the world, as it was known then. They all worked together. There was no fighting. There was no backbiting. There was no suicide bombers. There was none of that stuff. And civilization grew by leaps and bounds. I probably told you once before, but I'm going to tell you again. That's where your checkbook came from. It was from the Muslims back then. That's how far-reaching the Muslim influence was when they were doing what they were told to do. We know the story of the Jews and how they drifted away and they started doing their own thing. And they paid for it, and they were dispersed. But they always hung on to Jerusalem, and they wanted it to come back. Because all these prophecies that they'd been reading and poring over and interpreting in their own minds about what they wanted it all to be, because they were under pressure and they didn't like their lifestyle. And that's 20 or 30 more sermons there. It really is. And it was mentioned in Sunday school class, which also I think walked all over this sermon, up here in the adult class. And one of the reasons that the Jews didn't recognize Christ when he came is because it wasn't their definition of what the Messiah was. He did not come in there and make sweeping changes and throw the Romans out and change the social and economic structure of that country. He came in there to save them from sin. Remember the definition of sin and all the little elements? What they missed is if you save yourself from sin and you quit doing all those things that sin said, you become a great nation. But they didn't want to mess with all of that because that wasn't in their Mishnah or in their oral law. It was in their text, which they refused to read. But they revered greatly, still do. Make a big show of carrying it around all wrapped up in fancy wrappings, even today. And they still don't read it. Kind of like a lot of people do with the Bible. So they've got this Messiah that's not come, and they've got this upstart that comes in and starts teaching them all of these things that they're not interested in, right? So they kill him, right? Because they accused him of being king of the Jews. They were saying that he says he's the king of the Jews. He didn't argue with them because he knew the process and all that was supposed to go on like we all do. He was to be crucified on the cross and he was to be resurrected. He knew the big picture. So the Jews are still waiting for their Messiah, right? Well, what did Jesus Christ say when he comes the next time? Is he going to come in a little baby in a manger? That's not what our scriptures say. Our scriptures say that he's coming in all his glory. Right? Just like the Jews said he's supposed to come. So, my supposition is, or my question to you maybe is, when he makes his second coming on this earth, are the Jews going to recognize him as a Messiah? I think so. Because he's going to come differently. See, I can really muddle your mind up. Religion tells them to do, and then you've got people that are sinning in all three of those because of the way they're behaving and the way they're thinking and their attitudes, which therefore are their actions. And they're pointing their fingers at each other and condemning all of those weird, strange people that believe in this heathen thing. Now, am I promoting Judaism or am I promoting Muslims? Absolutely not. I believe in Jesus Christ, and I believe everything that is recorded about Jesus Christ in the Bible and in the Book of Mormon. I don't believe commentaries. And it's my job to stand up here and get you to think about what Jesus Christ died for you for, to help you get away from sin, and for you to think about your definition and my definition of that word and where it came from and what it means and what's really a sin in our lives. One of the big sins with the Jews was if they didn't do all of their ceremonies just right, they were sinners because they didn't do all these ceremonies right. Didn't have anything to do with what was in their hearts. Had to do with what was in their ceremonies. Didn't matter what was in their hearts. If you go over there today to Palestine or you go over there to Israel today and you start talking about peace, you're going to find out that in today's day over there that they don't know what that word means. It's not a part of their concept. How we can go over there and tell them they got to be peaceable, we may as well go over there and, like somebody comes in here and talks Chinese to me, they don't understand what you're talking about. That's not part of their fabric. A Christian, if you go to Israel and you ask a Jew over there what a Christian is, he tells you it's a political party. It doesn't have anything to do with their religion. If you find a Christian Jew over there, he belongs to the Christian political party. That isn't what we think a Christian is. Jesus Christ came to save us from our sins. Everything that I read about Jesus Christ in these two books points to that. It says it 100 different ways, maybe more than 100 different ways on all these points because we're all different. And each one of, there's 100 or so of us out here. Each one of us is going to have a passage in these scriptures where that switch is flipped if we read it the way it's supposed to be read. One of the things we tend to do, take this passage here and this passage here, and that's it. And then we hang our hat in that, and anybody that disagrees with us, we get mad at them. It's called doctrinal differences. If I think this way about this passage, and Maureen thinks that way about this passage, and Debbie, I'm just picking on you guys now, this, because I'm not even telling you what the passages are, and you think differently, where's the sin in that? The sin's getting mad and fighting about it and stabbing each other in the back and gossiping and doing all of the things that sin does. And we will never resolve our differences about the interpretation of that passage as long as we participate in sin while we're trying to take care of it. Because being mad is a sin. And I don't listen to somebody when I'm emotionally wrought up. And I don't make the correct decisions when I'm emotionally wrought up. And my improper decisions produce my improper behavior, which is what Maureen would then read about me, instead of what I'm trying to say. I did this years ago. It might even have been in the old building. But I got saddled with Sunday school class one day, and Gary Welch was in that Sunday school class. And I passed out some paper here. And I informed these people that Gary was going to give them a test. And I wanted them to do it. Remember that, Gary? So I lay out all these rules to Gary and to the group. But while I'm doing that, I'm getting in Gary's zone. I get right up against him and I make him uncomfortable and I bump his shoulder. And I tell him he's got 2 minutes. And then after about 20 seconds, I tell him to start. And everything I did to Gary for laying out what I was telling him to do, I did not do it because I wanted him distracted. And all it was a square and a rectangle, a triangle, and a circle. And it was connected with four straight lines. Those four things are connected, and that's all he had to do was tell you how to put it on your paper. And by the time I got him done, he was so rattled that he couldn't do it. I wouldn't let him think about what he wanted to talk about. And therefore, he could sit there and he could see that thing perfectly. But he couldn't talk about it because I got in his zone and I rattled his cage as best I could without being physical about it. And kept his mind from his true thing, which was to accurately describe to the people in the class what was on that paper. And that was my point. You can't think when you're mad. Therefore, you can't say what you really think when you're mad. And you can't hear when you're mad. And you can't hear when you're afraid. You can't hear when you're defensive. First thing they told us in firearms training, when you come down to the combat part, they said, now you got to remember when you get scared and somebody's shooting at you, that your peripheral vision comes down to this and it's all a reflex. So you better be learning things that are reflex. And the guy's going to be on the average of 8 feet away from you and it's going to last 6 seconds. Try to make all the decisions you're supposed to make as a cop before you do or do not pull the trigger on that. Because you're already scared to death, and I really honestly mean scared to death. Because you think you're about to get killed. And you're supposed to make a decision there that the judges and the jurors will look at for the next 3 years. It's the same process. If we as a group can't sit down and look at the scriptures in an applicable way, in a functional way, without sin in our hearts, we'll never solve our differences. And the scary part about it is, you all do this, and you all get it done, and you all successfully do this. All 100 and some of you out here. Now you got to go outside. That's where it really starts. If I think a Muslim's terrible, so I go get me a gun and I run out here and everybody that's got a scarf on their head or a long big beard, I go down the road and I start shooting because I want to kill all these Muslims because they're anti-Christ. That's not right. That's not what the scriptures tell me to do about how to handle problems. And it tells you to face and handle problems. It tells you that. It doesn't tell you to go stick your head in the sand. It tells you to handle them correctly. That's what it tells you to do. And you're to do it without sin. That passage that I read over here in the third book of Nephi, about what I called Jesus Christ's orientation speech, there's so much in that. There's so much information in that passage I read. There is so much in there. And our tendency is to read it and read it and read it and agree with it and agree with it and read it and agree with it, and pretty soon we know it by heart, and then we don't know what it means. We've forgotten our first love. We've forgotten the zeal of the gospel. We're getting into the mechanics of it now. Because early on in Deuteronomy, there's just one verse I'm going to close with. And it tells us how we're supposed to do this Bible and this Book of Mormon, and how we're supposed to take the things that it contains and figure out what it's really telling us about ourselves and making us look in our spiritual mirror or our emotional mirror or our psychological mirror. That's the three important mirrors for us to be looking at. Humbly, in other words, that's really what I'm doing. And change it. 13th chapter of Deuteronomy, I'm going to close with one verse. It's going to take the rest of your lives to do this verse. And don't forget, you're in your latter days. Because after you die, you don't have any more from this day forward. Fourth verse. You shall walk after the Lord your God and fear Him. That means respect Him. That doesn't mean stand around and tremble. And keep His commandments. And obey His voice. That doesn't mean finding out what the voice... Don't go on some big investigation of what the voice of God sounds like and doing that. His voice is what those words are that comes out of these page, off these pages to you. And ye shall serve Him and cleave, which means cling to Him. That's our job. We have what we call the fullness of the gospel. What does that mean to you? So it's a phrase that this church uses. What does it mean to you? Is it some theological ivory tower, grand and glorious definition? Or is it something that you can stick in your heart and use while you're reading the scriptures? I hope it's the latter. Thank you for your time.